Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is guitarist and music entrepreneur Eric Himmel. But let's start with this. According to The Guardian, there's a whole generation of kids that may never develop a love for music because they just don't have access to it. These are the pre-phone children who have virtually no musical autonomy at all. Listening to music depends totally on their parents. Now, most kids under the age of 10 don't have access to CDs or vinyl or even the radio. Even when they're online, so much of our technology is coded by 25-year-olds working for companies run by 37-year-olds, and they may not have raised children and don't have friends who have, so they're not aware of this problem. And if you recall back to your childhood, usually you find a song that you really like and you play it over and over and over if you're able to. But if there's no music playing device at home and you don't have access to a phone, then you're out of luck. The average age of when a kid gets a phone is between 10 and 15 years old. And yes, sometimes kids get an old phone or a tablet hand-me-down, but most parents really want to rein in screen time, so that applies here even when it comes to music. Can a passion for music be cultivated if you don't have access to it when you're a child? Problem is, we don't know yet. Kids really do need music as a form of nourishment, but there's a school of thought that says they'll have more of a connection with gaming than music if lack of music exposure continues on this path. That's not good news for the future of the music business. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all of my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. Now, you might have heard of the cocktail party effect. This happens when you're in a noisy group of people, but you're able to zero in on a conversation even with all the noise going on. This is a unique ability that humans have, but the problem is you lose that ability if you're wearing hearing aids or noise-canceling headphones. Now, researchers at the University of Washington have developed an AI system that lets you use off-the-shelf headphones fitted with the microphone so you can zero in on speakers' voices in the room while canceling everything out. What happens here is headphones are fitted with the microphone and that's connected to an onboard embedded computer. All you have to do is look at a person for 3 to 5 seconds, and then the system latches onto that speaker's voice and continues to play it back to the listener even if you or the speaker is moving around the room. This actually improves the more the speaker keeps talking, because the system is getting more training data. Now, as you probably surmised, this system is still experimental, but the research team is working to expand its use to earbuds and hearing aids in the future. Is this creepy or useful? As with everything, it all depends on how you use it. My guest this week is Eric Himmel, who expanded his touring guitar career into hosting the hottest jam night in Hollywood, to producing a Las Vegas show, to custom music programming for private and corporate events. Eric's credits include Paraman 5000, the Russian supergroup Movie Troll, Alan Parsons, Eagles of Death Metal, Puddle of Mud, Candlebox, Robbie Krieger, Michael DeBar, and many more. He was the longtime host of the Sunset Jam, which was the longest-running residency show at the world-famous Viper Room in Hollywood, grossing $1 million plus and showcasing over 1,500 performers and numerous sponsorship collaborations. He's also been the co-producer of 27, A Musical Adventure, which is a retrospective concert honoring the music icons gone too early at age 27. The show had a multi-year residency in Virgin Hotels, Las Vegas, with over 120 performances. During our interview, we talked about playing music with lyrics you can't understand, the hack he used to get his first tour, his unique approach to running a jam night, creating a corporate event music business, moving to Paris and what the music scene is like there, and so much more. I spoke with Eric via Zoom from his home in Los Angeles. growing up in Pittsburgh, I'm sure you played in a lot of bands. So let's start there. Let's start with you beginning to play and take me through a little bit of your early history.
Okay. Well, I discovered guitar probably around age 10 or 12. I had a friend who played, and this was when digital cameras were just starting. And they started doing video also. So on our daily announcements on the televisions in the classroom, I had a friend who would play guitar sometimes. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. And that started the journey and obviously loving music. But yes, with that same guy, we joined and started a band together. And, you know, classic story. Oh, we're going to move to LA after high school. It's going to be our band is going to make it. Well, you know, I played in that band and several cover bands and tribute bands up until the end of high school, and nobody wanted to move to LA except for me. So I stayed back a couple more years. I went to college, and then once I made a deal with myself, once I finished college, I would leave, and I did. But I played in a couple tribute bands, you know, an Alice Cooper tribute band with full theatrical stage show, which was kind of fun.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so
That one taught me a lot about how to perform, get out of the way, make sure there's like no swinging swords or snakes on stage, you know, always be aware of what's around you.
Yeah, performance is a big part of it. When I first started, I was playing 5, 6, 7 nights a week when I was in high school. And, you know, after a while, you realize that, okay, I got some pretty good chops from playing all the time, but it's a little bit more to it. There's more performance involved.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you got to LA. What happened then? So you're a smart guy, so you probably had a plan when you came out here. But that being said, how long did it take before you actually got on your feet?
You know, I did have a plan, actually. And the entire time I was playing music and going to school, I had a full-time job back in Pittsburgh, and I transferred that job to LA. So basically what happened was I dreamt and dreamt about LA, and I went on a trip. I think it was probably April 2009 with a friend of mine, and she had been coming out here a lot, modeling and going to parties and things. This was like when the Hollywood was like buzzing, you know, there was something every night in the Hollywood Hills, all this stuff. It's a little different now, but, and she brought me out, and immediately within the first, I don't know, 2 hours, the stuff that I saw was unbelievable, and I was hooked. And I got back to Pittsburgh after 4 or 5 days in LA, and I put a plan together, and I left 2 months later. But I did. I had my job. I transferred my job. So I had complete financial security upon arrival, which was good. But that didn't last too long, because obviously I wanted to play music. And if you're tied up working, you know, 60 hours a week, you can't do anything. You can't play music. And I quit my job to go on a tour that never happened. So it very quickly got me accustomed to a lot of things of how the business works. And don't, you know, cash the check until you have it in your hand, you know, kind of thing. And I went from a really high paying salary job in Beverly Hills at 21 years old to busting tables at a bar called the Happy Endings Bar on Sunset and La Brea after the tour didn't happen. And it just instilled in me, you know, okay, you're going to have to commit to this completely if you want to go anywhere with it, you know. And it was good. It was actually a good thing that all that happened the way it did.
You have a good attitude about it.
Well, in hindsight, it's easy to be accepting of it, you know.
Yeah.
In the time, it's
I want to jump ahead a little bit. How did you get with Mumy Troll? And how did that work?
So, Mumy Troll is one of Russia's most popular rock bands ever. I got hooked up with those guys through Jeff Greenberg at the Village Studios. You know, a mutual friend of ours was recording at the Village and knew me, and Jeff was managing the band at the time for all of their US operations, helping them book tours, because at the time the singer is basically kind of the band, and he was writing English versions of his really famous Russian songs, trying to break into English and American markets. So it was really through Jeff. I started with them in 2014, and I did 3 or 4 years pretty heavily with them, you know, going to Russia almost every other weekend and seeing all different cities all throughout Russia. And actually, since the war, began, I started working with them again, doing private parties in Europe and the US because of the restrictions that the musicians face over in Russia trying to leave.
Did you have a problem with the language barrier or anything?
No, you know, that's the interesting thing about this is, you know, most people when they're in their parents, they go to England or they go somewhere and visit as kids. They go, I don't know, Mexico. I don't know where families go on vacation, but they usually go somewhere, right? And for me, I'd been to Canada being so close in Pittsburgh. But the first place I ever left the United States was Russia. So I didn't go to England. I didn't go to France. I went right to Russia. And even when I was going to Russia in 2013, 14, people still didn't have such a favorable view of it. And everybody was like, you need to be kidding. The place was booming. You know, there was nothing to be worried about at the time. But it really like kind of hardened my skin a lot on how to travel internationally and how to conduct myself internationally. And it never bothered me because I didn't know any different. You know, that was what I was exposed to, was that language barrier. I mean, it took a little hump to understand the music, but it's the same as Western music. They just speak in Russian. So if you can learn the melody or have some frame of reference, you know, it's not that hard.
Okay. Well, let's go there for a second. So is the phrasing different? Because a lot of times the music breathes the phrasing of the vocalist.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure because I haven't heard a lot of Russian music, but because of the language, you'd think the phrasing would be different. Is that true?
It is in some ways because they do have different alphabet. The Cyrillic alphabet has, you know, sounds that the English or Latin alphabet doesn't have. But the thing that's interesting about those kind of songs is you cannot really translate them. You kind of have to learn the melody as it sits. Like I could probably recite two or three of their songs completely from memory in Russian, but I can't tell you what it means, but I can at least sing the melody of the song. But if you try to translate it to English so you could understand it, you won't be able to play it or understand the song the way it's meant to be because of the difference in the language. So it's kind of strange. You have to learn the song in Russian, but you don't know what the song is in a lot of ways. So that's actually kind of challenging.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit. So you come to LA and then your tour falls apart and you're bussing tables. What happened then?
I think just an amount of persistence. You know, that tour that fell through, I actually still work for that artist. And she was like my first big job. And the crazy thing about that one was Musicians Institute used to have a website where you could go on and look at postings for jobs. And I didn't go to Musicians Institute. I went to Robert Morris University in Pittsburgh, a business college. I actually have zero to little musical training whatsoever. But on the Musicians Institute website used to be able to look at these postings. And because I had a college.edu email address, I was able to somewhat hack in and see all the job postings. So that's how I got this tour audition, was by using a not musiciansinstitute.edu email. And I ended up still being friends with that client and working for her over the years. But the tour that she had initially contracted for is the one that fell apart. But I think just persistence. You know, the producer of that project was very encouraging. He told me a lot of good insights, such as, you know, the one that always sticks with me is a good adage for the music business is however long you think it's going to take, double it. And that stuck in with me, like even till to this day, like when I'm trying to get paid or when I'm trying to get a schedule, I'm like, you know what, just double what I think my expectations will be. But it was just persistence. You know, it was meeting people in town. And that producer gave me a really good tip. He said, find 10 people you want to be like. You know, I didn't read any Tony Robbins or any of that kind of stuff up until this point in my life. And he said, just find 10 people that you'd want to model yourself like. And the first one on my list was Tim Pierce. And I immediately reached out to Tim and we became really good friends. We're still friends. I just had dinner with him on Monday. And I just started looking at these guys that were doing what I was doing and just asking them questions like, how do I do this? How do I break in? How do I play what you play? How do I come up with stuff like you do? And that was it. It was just a matter of searching because there's no blueprint to be a professional musician. It was kind of just throwing anything I could to the wall and see what would stick. And finally, after a lot of trial and error and playing in bands in LA that, you know, failed record deals or all these things that we see starry eyes, you know, I made a big commitment to only play music for financial reasons. And when I did that, a lot of things changed for me.
Okay, so you're only playing if you got money from it. And I get it, because LA is famous, well, you can probably say that for Nashville and New York and London, for that matter, but it's famous for the carrot. You know, if you do this, then this is going to happen. And the famous, oh, it'll be good exposure.
And pay my rent with exposure, you know?
Right. Okay. Then you started to play a lot, but you expanded from there and you started to put together shows. Did it start from when you did the Viper Room?
Yeah. You know what it was? Is just like with that tour that never happened, you know, I started working for Mumy Troll and, you know, same thing happened. I remember there was kind of a tour because they were doing this American trying to break into America thing. And I would play some shows. There would be another guitar player that played a bunch of shows. Sometimes we would play together. And I remember there was, I don't know, 10 or 15 shows like through Singapore and Belarus and all these places. And about a week before the tour, I got pulled from the tour and I had already counted how much money I was going to make. I was like ready to go. You know, I had already spent the money in my mind, you know, what I was going to do with this tour money. And they pulled the rug from underneath me and they said, well, you can go to South Korea and do these shows and this Chinese show. And I just started realizing like, wow, this is going to be just, this is the ride. You know, I have to buckle up for this. And then I found some other work. I actually was the band leader at Six Flags Magic Mountain the next year, like the next summer after this touring cycle was over. And that band, we had learned, you know, I don't know, 5 sets of music. And so randomly, I just started getting calls from friends of mine in Hollywood that knew I played music, but they were in restaurants and bars. And they said, why don't you come down and play? So the Six Flags band ended up starting to do local gigs in Hollywood, playing the same set we did at the theme park in the daytime. And I started realizing how much more money I could make if I organized everything and I put it together and I put the deals together. And I was like, wow, this is a really good thing, you know? And it did transition to promoting shows and doing, you know, and ever since I was a kid, I did the website for my band. I booked all the shows. I did everything anyways, but I never found a way to monetize it until then. And then going to do that weekly series at the Viper Room was a huge door opener for me. Huge.
For those listening that don't know what that is, the Viper Room is on Sunset Boulevard. And it was a very famous venue for years and years and years. And every Monday night, was it there was a jam?
Yeah. So we did a jam program every Monday night where, you know, the house band would be made up of some big touring musicians, you know, guys that play now the drummers on tour with Bruce Dickinson and keyboard players out with Niall Horan and Beyonce. And so it was a good way for younger musicians to come in, see and meet professional touring people, and also a way to, for me, to invite some of my colleagues and stuff that, you know, there was no opportunity for us to really play together. They would come down and bring their friends. So it just spiraled. And it actually, you know, there's a few other nights like that in LA where you can find it, but it seems to be kind of pigeonholed, where it's either a blues jam or it's a classic rock jam. This one, I made it a real point to play all music. You know, R&B, pop, top 40. And that really attracted a diverse crowd, a younger crowd. And actually a lot of, I'd say at least 60% of the audience was non-musician, which is actually what I was going for the whole time. You know, musicians don't tend to spend money at the bar. You know, they all want to network and play and get gigs, which is totally cool. But the only way you can sustain a night is if the bar makes money. So I realized early on that I said I have to make a focus to not only keep the music a priority, but don't forget what we're doing here. You know, let's not forget, otherwise we won't have a night.
When did you start that?
We did it January 2016, and it ran every week until COVID happened. So probably 200 10 shows, 215 shows.
Well, just to show you now, when I first got into LA in the 80s, it was going on.
Yeah.
But not like that. It was more, it was a very, very loose jam. And it was almost like, okay, is any guitar players? Okay, come on up.
Yeah.
It was space. It was, yeah. It was very disorganized.
Yeah. This, well, when we did it, we made it a focus to be very organized so that we could play songs that you wouldn't normally hear. You know, not, you can't just go out in the audience and say, does anybody know like Thin Lizzy, Bad Reputation? You know, it has guitar harmonies on it and all kinds of stuff. So we always found a way to give the songs in advance to people so it could be a really unique thing, you know, and people could show up doing their best also, you know. Not everybody's a great improviser or has a great ear training to just play on the spot, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great idea. Very cool. All right. So then you're doing still, I think, a lot of corporates, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, doing, like I said, I made a decision just to make money for music. Now, it doesn't mean I don't have passion for music. It doesn't mean I don't love it. It doesn't mean it's not everything to me. It's just that it's music business. So to just play guitar and not make any money is not very good business sense. So I found different avenues to always, you know, do it. And through that night, you know, we had a lot of sponsorship deals, you know, where they would provide money from time to time. They would provide gear. There were so many opportunities beyond just playing guitar that I started thinking also about how to expand my business. Because if I'm on stage, I'm only getting paid one time and that's when I'm playing. So if I start creating event bands, corporate bands, I could have three or four paychecks in one night and I could perform in one event and I could send somebody to do another event. So yeah, through that, it really expanded my mindset because I saw the potential of how much what you could do with it. You know, a lot of people sometimes will just, I have to get in a band and I have to tour. Well, if I'm on tour, which I was at the time in 2017 with a rock band called Power Man 5000, I was still getting paid from the Vipe Room because the show was still happening every week. So I started thinking, oh man, I could have five of these a night. I could have six of these. I could have 10 of these. So yeah, I started creating event bands and corporates.
I always heard about a guy in New York City that did much the same thing only with wedding bands.
Yeah.
And he had like a dozen different wedding bands that he could send out on any given weekend. And he made a fortune for years and years. I heard his name, but it's not somebody that you'd know.
Yeah.
He made his fortune doing it.
Mark Concept.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay. So I don't know the timeline here, but eventually you moved to Paris part-time,
yeah,
right?
Well, that's the most recent developments, you know, but you know, the thing that's really interesting, right, is we don't have a crystal ball, right? We don't know what the future holds at anything that we're going to do. But I can tell you for me and myself that I sometimes do tend to get bored easily. So having event bands and things like that, or that Monday night where you're playing different styles of music a lot, keeps things fresh. It keeps it interesting. You know, I was always thinking, like, even when I go on tour, by the third show, I'm like, oh God, we're going to have to play the same set for another 30 days.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
I just always like challenging myself, you know, and you kind of just eventually go into autopilot and you do it. But I don't know what it was. I'd say about, let's see, I started that thing January 2016. I'd say probably around the end of 2019, I was kind of like, you know what? This has had a good run. We've done really well. The bar does good numbers. We've grossed over $1 million in revenue for the bar on Monday nights, on an off night. I mean, people have been seen. Musical directors have come in and people have gotten gigs from it. I kind of started with like, what's next? You know, and I probably didn't put as much effort into the night as I should have at the time, but I was, you know, I was just trying to think about what else was going on. And I met a man there who came in and he goes, a few weeks ago, I saw a guy on stage playing Kurt Cobain, you know, Nirvana music, who looked like Kurt Cobain. He goes, who was it? And I said, well, it's my friend Gabe. He goes, well, I've always had this idea to put together this show about the 27 Club, about all the dead rock stars, you know, Amy Winehouse and Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin. And like most things you hear in LA, it goes in one ear and out the other. I go, okay, well, I've heard this a million times. This guy wants to do this and he wants to do this show, or he has this script, develop it. Well, this guy was really serious, you know, and he kept calling me and he goes, did you think I was serious about this? I go, no, that's why I didn't answer the phone. Like, I didn't want to sit and talk to you about an idea that's not going to happen. Well, he was very serious and he put up a lot of money and we developed the show and I co-produced the show and co-owned the show with them. And we went to Las Vegas during COVID and we did 150 shows at the Virgin Hotel of this 27 club. And that was the pre-Paris move, but that's what I was doing during COVID. And you never know where you're going to go when you're doing something. And like, I didn't know that I would be splitting my time now in Europe, but that's the most recent thing.
Okay. So what brought that on though? Why did you go to Europe?
Well, you know, after, I don't really remember the timeline because I was in LA for most of 2020. Nobody was working or at least touring, you know, and up until then, most of my business was primarily touring. At the time, I had a big studio. You know, I had every piece of guitar gear that existed, every 80s, 2290, H3000. I had everything. And I had enough independent clients, you know, TDQs and all that stuff. And I had kind of a nice machine going. But COVID just stopped everything, you know. It was a good time for everybody to kind of clear their heads and kind of reevaluate things. But I went to Vegas to do this show with my partner, Rainey. And when I went to Vegas, it kind of lifted this fear I had that if I left LA, the world would end or something, or people would actually seemingly care if I left or something. And when I left, nothing happened except for I flourished in Vegas and was a, you know, an owner of a casino residency that we sold to Richard Branson and Virgin Hotels. So actually, leaving opened up so much more opportunity to me that I'd never thought about before, you know. And it's funny is I had this other guy who was kind of a mentor in a lot of ways, and he had me write down a few things. And I think it was like 2018 where I wrote down Las Vegas show, and I didn't even remember about this list of stuff I wrote until I got to Vegas. I go, well, that's right. And I actually have a treatment on my computer of a potential Vegas show that I wrote myself back 2018, but I'll try to make it quick here. Is when I left, nothing bad happened except good things. When our show closed up at the beginning of 2022, we did a few corporates and things like that with the 27 show. I had also just gone through a bunch of personal things. I'm like, you know what? I need a break. You know, I've toured the world a lot, but up until that point, I don't think I ever went on like one real vacation. So I went one way to Europe, 2022, April 2022. And I don't know, I went to Prague, Budapest, Paris. I went all these places that I never went on tour that I dreamt about going. And I really started to take it all in after being over there for 8 weeks. I just went one way. I was there for 8 weeks, tons of different cities. And it really started sparking my curiosity about how people live there. Came back to the U.S. summer of 2022. 3 weeks later, was super restless again, left again on another 7 week, you know, just one way, you know. And LA was still, I think, kind of closed at the time. I don't remember the timeline of when people started touring again, but I remember leaving because there wasn't any real opportunity, you know, here. So it kind of got brought about just by chance.
But you decided to stay over there at least part time.
Yeah. Well, up until that point, around end of 2022, I did come back to LA from Vegas full time. And when I came back from Vegas, I mean, everything is a matter of perception, right? You know, and for me, the LA that I had gotten really used to and loved was totally gone, like completely unrecognizable. And I still have a place over in West Hollywood. So my time in LA is basically 14 years on the Sunset Strip, you know, right there. And when I came back, I just said, you know what, why would I stay here when there's places all around the world that are like booming? Like you went over to Europe and the place was packed. People were all everywhere. And at the same time, I came to LA and it was closed. There were still restrictions in LA. And it just didn't sit with me. I go, well, why would I just go here when it's not happening? I can go somewhere else that's open with opportunities. And that's what it was for me, you know. And it like anything, you know, I'm a very analytical person. So I took about 8 months to formulate a plan. And now my plan is working. I split my time between Paris and LA.
Tell me about the differences in the scene, the music scene, between Paris, for instance, and LA.
Yeah, well, for Paris, I kind of look at Paris as my office right now. You know, I do all my bookings. You know, I keep my musical direction service going, where I have several clients that I put their bands together, rehearse their bands, create their arrangements and shows. Since the war in Ukraine, my musical direction services for Russian artists has increased again. So I have this strange niche where I've probably worked for 6 or 7 of the biggest Russian artists ever, or Ukrainians, you know, any of those ex-Soviet countries. And like, I have another one that I just started working with, this guy, Misha Bublik. We have some performances next month, but I kind of use Paris as my office because as a scene, I've dove in a bit, but I will say this, that there's a reason that everybody comes to LA. I mean, this is literally the best of the best. And I'm not saying there's not great musicians everywhere, because there are. But for a concentration of amazing players in one place, I don't think you can beat LA. You know, maybe London, you know, has a great scene also, but Paris is not totally a music city in a lot of ways. That's why I kind of use it. I don't really play there, to be honest. I use it as a way, as a lifestyle choice, and a way to work on my business that's here in the U.S.
Okay, what's the best music scene in Europe then?
From what I gather, it would be London or Berlin, you know, one of those two. They hire a lot of bands, you know, British bands, Adele, Rita Ora, a lot of those guys are London-based. So I think if you're looking for something that's as mainstream as L.A. or Nashville, it would be London for sure. And obviously, Stockholm is an amazing place for songwriting. How many pop hits have been come out of Sweden in the last, you know, 40 years? But now it's a huge bustling scene for modern pop.
Yeah, they're especially good there at that.
Yeah. I haven't really checked that out yet, but I do have some friends that have publishing deals over there and tell me how great it is and how, you know, how much opportunity there is.
I was in Iceland last year, the year before, I think, and I was shocked about the scene there. It was very cool. It was a great place, nice people, and it was a really good music scene. Who would have thought?
Yeah, and you know, now with the internet the way it is, do you really need to be in a music center? I don't know, you know? And I kind of look at it for myself as, do people know that I moved to Paris part-time? Maybe. But my phone still rings, so it hasn't interrupted any of my business. But also, I've lived in Los Angeles since 2009. My phone is full of people I can call in a moment's notice to do things. If I had just graduated Berkeley or something, I think you'd have to go directly to the source somewhere. You know, so far, this is working for me because I've spent so much time cultivating relationships here or around the world, you know, when I'm touring.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how it would work. I think you'd still have to go there, you know, nowadays.
Okay, let's talk gear for a second, because I know you've cycled through a lot of gear. You've seen a lot of gear. What's your take on amplifier modeling?
I think it's great. You know, I've owned all of them. All of them, I think I've owned except for the Quad Cortex. I've never used that, but my good friend Paul Ill uses that one with his bass rig, and it sounds great. But I like them because they're consistent. And if you really think about it, you know, unless you have somebody that really knows what they're doing, you know, you're taking this big guitar amp, you're taking a microphone, a SM57 with a capsule the size of a quarter, and you're hoping that your front of house engineer placed it exactly where it's supposed to be to get the best sound, and you're hoping that it's mixed properly. When you have the amp modeler, everything just stays the same all the time. Once you have a great sound, you know that everybody else is going to hear it.
When Line 6 was coming out with their unit, I can't remember the name of it right now.
The Helix,
yeah. So before that came out, they asked me to evaluate some samples. It was a blind test. And what it was the best signal path you can think of, mic'd what they really excellent amplifier, excellent microphones, the whole deal, and their sample. And after a while, I got good at telling which was which. So I would know. But that being said, most of the time I preferred their version. I preferred the model version to the one that was real.
There's so many variables that go into it, you know, and especially for recording, right? There's so many variables. And this is the thing about modeling that nobody touches on, right? I'm in my mid to late 30s, right? So I've played literally every amplifier that exists. I know what a Vox is supposed to sound like. I know what a Vox with a Tube Screamer is supposed to sound like. I know what a Vox with a CE2 chorus is. I know every single sound pretty accurately of what it is. So when you have a younger player and they've never had access or the ability to use that equipment, and you give them a Kemper and they say, oh, here's a Fender Tweed, they have no frame of reference.
Yeah.
And so when I hear a profile or a sound and it says what it is, or it claims to say what it is, I know what I need to do to get the sound that's in my head. And that's the thing about the modelers that is challenging, is unless you've used the real thing and you've used a 57 or you've used a 421 placed on the edge of the capsule and you've used a Reuter in the center, and then you have no frame of reference. You're just going by what you think the profile is supposed to be and what it's supposed to sound like. And then there's the final equation, if you're recording, is your monitors. If you don't, like, I know that you use Amphions, and I love Amphions also, because to me, they're very flat and transparent. What you hear is really it. And if you don't know the EQ curve of your monitors and you don't know what a Fender Tweed is supposed to sound like, I mean, sure, that doesn't mean you can't put up a sound and just be creative and have a guitar part on a hit record or make a loop that goes on splice. I'm not that, you can absolutely do that. But I think fundamentally understanding the sound and how you got there is one thing that's kind of lost, because the modelers make it so easy and there's not enough access to the original gear anymore.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, that's just the industrial knowledge of the business that
right.
kind of disappears whether you wanted to or not. I mean, there's a lot of recording knowledge in general. One of the reasons why I write books is from the historical aspect as well. I don't want this knowledge to just go into the ether.
Yeah.
I think it's important that at least some of the techniques be documented.
Yeah, and it's funny because people end up going back to that anyways, you know. There's always the trend that goes, well, we want real amps, or we want to use a real console. We want to record live. So I guess it's always there. Depends how much you want to dive in. But I mean, in general, I really like them. I don't use them, to be quite honest, but that's only because of the nature of what I do. You know, I do so many one-offs and things that change. Now, if I had a 90 city show with an artist and we were doing, you know, arenas, yeah, I probably would just do a modeler and keep things easy. But when, you know, a lot of throw and go festivals and things, there's so many variables, and at least I want to feel comfortable. So if I have an amp that I'm familiar with and my pedals that I know how to use, at least I know the sound I'm giving whoever sounds good. What they do with it afterwards, I can't think about. You know, I have to just show up and play.
Okay, out of curiosity, what do you usually go out with then?
I usually try to get a Marshall. JCM 2000 or JCM 800 is usually pretty solid. And surprisingly, people don't realize that you can clean up the 800 so much. You know, all those In Excess records from the 80s were all done on an 800, which I really like. So, you know, I usually will backline a Marshall. Then I don't have to bring as many pedals to get the gain staging, you know, at least. If I have like a Fender Hot Rod, I have to bring, you know, two distortion pedals, or I mean, one overdrive, one distortion. But I try to limit it as much as possible on fly dates.
And guitars, what do you take?
Always Les Paul. You know, I have all the other stuff that I need, but I usually just gravitate towards Les Paul, especially if I'm the only guitar player in the band. If I'm a second guitar player, then I'll make a more conscious choice to do a Tele or a Strat or something that maybe sounds a little thinner, you know, depending on the music.
You're young. Your back is still strong. You can do that.
I don't know about that. I mean, I was having this discussion last night with a couple friends at dinner, and like, he goes, man, my basses are like 13, 14 pounds. He plays these 5-string Spectres. I don't know. I mean, Les Paul is enough for me, let alone a 13-pound.
No, you know, kidding. Bass. Wow. Yeah, that's a real job just to carry that sucker around.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
All right, Eric, last question. I think you might have answered this, but maybe you have an additional answer. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you?
I would have to say that, yeah, for sure, it's don't give up. And I say that in a way that I kind of feel that everybody gets at least one chance. People that move to LA, or maybe not even in music, you want to do something entrepreneurial, whatever. I think that if you put one foot in front of the other enough times, you will get one chance. Now, how you handle that is totally up to how you're prepared or how professional you are, whatever. But, you know, I have actor friends and, you know, same thing. I go, just stick with it because you will get an opportunity. I can't say you'll get it, but you'll get the opportunity. So it's that. Don't give up. I think somebody has to be doing it, right? You know, your heroes that are playing on stage with somebody had to have gotten the gig somehow. They were in the right place, the right time, right situation, but they were focused. They were determined. They didn't waver. You know, so that would be it.
I've noticed that too. When I first came to LA, everybody that, you know, we all started together, the people that kept with it might not be doing the same thing that we started. And, you know, everybody was a player at first. And, you know, eventually you have other opportunities that you follow, but it's the same thing. If you hang in, eventually you're doing okay.
So. Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think everybody really gets a shot. If you really, really want it, if your like life depends on playing music or being on stage, you will get an opportunity to allow it to be realized.
You can find out more about Eric at erichimmelmusic.com. That's Eric, E-R-I-K, Himmel, H-I-M-E-L, music, all one word, erichimmelmusic.com, and also at himmelentertainmentgroup.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.